I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Whether we like it or not, the impact of climate change is very real, and rising temperatures are causing the ice caps to melt at an alarming rate. So we've got to ask, what's happening to the animals who call the North Pole home? Today we'll speak with two scientists who spent last summer in the Arctic. Most of their research has focused on one species in particular, the polar bear. A rather disheartening statistic estimates that their population could be reduced by two-thirds by the year 2050. We'll find out how the changing ecosystem is affecting polar bears and whether they can adapt in time to escape extinction. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Polar bears live on sea ice, but as we all know, sea ice is disappearing at an alarming rate. That raises an impossible-to-avoid question. What happens to the polar bears then? One forecast suggests that two-thirds could be gone in the next 30 years. By the turn of the century, they may all be gone. Now, a conversation about what's happening to our ice caps and what that may mean for the animals who live there. With us are two scientists from Polar Bears International. Alyssa McCall is Director of Conservation Outreach. Alyssa, good morning.
Good morning.
And Marissa Kraus is the Programs Manager. Marissa, good to have you.
Thank you for having us.
You guys are like a tag team with your names being so similar.
We are.
Alyssa, tell us about this forecast and this possibility that two-thirds of the Earth's polar bears could be gone by 2050. I'm wondering why and what's driving that.
Sure. Well, that is worst-case scenario. What's really driving it is our increased use of fossil fuels. As we're burning fossil fuels for transportation and heating, we're releasing rampant amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, which acts as a heat-trapping blanket. And we're thickening this blanket, trapping too much heat, and we all know ice melts when it's warm, and polar bears depend on sea ice to catch their main prey seals. They really need that blubber that they can only find out over the water on the ice.
Marissa, explain that to us. Why do polar bears need seals so desperately?
Well, polar bears have evolved for a life upon the sea ice, and they eat seals, and without sea ice, they can't hunt seals.
How does that work? How do they hunt seals on sea ice?
Well, I'm going to pass that over to my the polar bear scientist, Alyssa, over here.
How do they do it, Alyssa?
Sure. Well, they really use it as a platform. So there's a couple ways. The main way is they just wait by seals' breathing holes. So seals swim under the ice, have to come up for air, and polar bears are very patient, and they'll sit and wait for ages. Polar bears are good swimmers, but they're not as good as seals, so they really can't catch seals in open water. They need some sort of platform to help them wait for the seals.
And what other species rely on the ice? I mean, how do they do it as well, Marissa? How does that work?
Well, you know, I think it's important to note that the sea ice is a whole ecosystem, okay? And so while polar bears rely on the sea ice, there's other Arctic species that rely on it as well. And some of the species that we talk about in some of our conservation outreach are also beluga whales. And right now, in a partnership with Explore.org, we do have a beluga whale camp up in the Churchill area. And Alyssa, do you have anything you'd like to comment on beluga whales?
Yeah, well, they need sea ice to protect them from killer whales. Mm. Killer whales have a dorsal fin, can't get up in the ice. Belugas are smooth-backed, so they go up in the ice and have protection. But when there's less ice, there's, you know, more killer whales.
I mean, they bump up against the top of the sea ice, and the killer whales can't get that high.
Exactly. And so belugas can breathe, and the killer whales can't. So it's protection.
I've also read, Alyssa, that polar bears have been reported swimming in the open ocean, presumably looking for sea ice, which is nowhere in sight. What a pathetic image that is in my head as I think about that.
You know, yeah, I was actually on a research paper that came out last year. Our record in that paper was a female swam 400 kilometers in 9 days. That's a long ways.
400 kilometers in 9 days?
Yeah.
A polar bear?
Yeah, you know, they're good swimmers, but we hope that they don't have to continue to do that. It's very energy intensive. And in some parts of the Arctic is worse than others for the swimming.
You know, these include females with cubs who are out in the open swimming here. There are also reports of bears found dead in open water. I mean, these bears are great endurance swimmers. So this is telling us what then?
Well, it's telling us that if we can't do anything to stop the ice from melting, we're going to see more of these things we really don't want to see. It just points to how important the sea ice is and keeping it around. And we know we can do that. Our message is really of hope. We know we can protect polar bears and sea ice. We don't want to see more and more bears swimming until they can't anymore.
We're talking with two scientists from Polar Bears International, Lisa McCall, Director of Conservation Outreach, and Marisa Kraus, who's the program's manager. Lisa, you know, some polar bears have actually been seen in what is usually grizzly territory. Are they as inherently good at finding various food sources as their cousins? I mean, can they adapt, or how's that working?
Yeah, you know, so grizzly bears' digestive system is made to eat land food, so they can handle eggs and berries and live fine off that. Polar bears can do that for a very short term, but they really need the calories only from the seals, and they have different genetics that makes it so they really need fat to survive long term.
That really shows you how wonky the ecosystem is if polar bears are showing up where grizzly bears normally hang out, right?
Right. So there's some areas that they've always overlapped, but they seem to be overlapping for longer periods in some areas.
Are those two kinds of bears, are they friendly to each other, or is this not a good thing?
So the grizzly bears tend to be more aggressive. They're going to start competing for some foods, that's not great. There's a little part of the Arctic where there's been a bit of hybridization, and we've seen some growler bears. But recent genetics have shown that all the growler bears that we found are all traced back to one female polar bear that, you know, had a thing for the brown bears. And so we don't think it'll continue.
Okay. And what do you call those again?
A growler bear.
Growler bears.
Yeah.
Okay. What about grizzlies? And when it comes to hibernating, they do that until what time of year?
Grizzly bears, I think it depends on what area you're in.
Yeah.
But yeah, usually till kind of late winter, early spring.
You know, with the ice cap getting smaller, the Arctic Ocean has opened up and nations are laying claim to whatever sections they can, and energy companies are ready to explore for oil. How does that affect the wildlife in the region? Either one of you. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's going to be a huge question moving forward. There is some work being done looking at if there's an oil spill in the Arctic, what is going to happen?
Yeah.
We know it will be devastating for polar bears, but probably also for other marine mammals. Polar bears would lick their fur right away and digest that oil, which would not be good. And we don't really have a great containment plan right now. So I know there are groups working on that. It's almost inevitable.
Yeah.
That it will happen at some point.
You know, Marisa, were both you guys up in polar bear country this summer?
You know, I was not up in Churchill this summer. My time spent in Churchill is primarily during some of our conservation outreach in the fall programming season.
And what do you do when you're up there?
Well, so one of the things that I do at Polar Bears International is run some of our conservation outreach programming, and a lot of that has to do with our Arctic Ambassador Center network. And that's a network of over 50 zoos and aquariums that we work with in the U.S., Canada, and Europe.
Yeah. And Alyssa, you're up there. You live up there.
I live up in Yellowknife. I live in the Northwest Territory, but luckily there's no polar bears right there. But I do spend a lot of time in Churchill, Manitoba, which is the polar bear capital of the world.
Where is Yellowknife?
So, well, it's just north of 60. It's kind of northern Canada, basically, on a big lake. It's a little chilly there.
And what do you do there?
So, well, I largely work from home for a lot of the year, but, you know, I get outside in the winter, and then I travel a lot for work. So I did some field work in Tuktoyaktuk, Northwest Territories, and then, like Marisa said, largely in Churchill in the summer and fall.
And the field work you do is what? What do you focus on?
So when we're out in the field, generally, we are doing mark recapture programs for polar bears. So if we want to really get at some of these biological questions, you know, we need to get hands-on. So go out in a helicopter, locate bears, tranquilize them for a short period of time, and measure them. Take samples, you know, ID them. They each get their own number, and then we track them over many years and get these long-term data sets so we can understand what's happening with the population.
So when you want to collar them and be able to track them, mm-hmm. tell us about that. You pass by it so quickly, but for those of us who live down here, this sounds kind of adventurous.
Like, no big deal.
Yeah,
actually, most of my research has been involved with collaring. So we've been collaring female polar bears for a couple decades now. They kind of like your dog wears a collar, but it has a GPS unit, and the collar talks to a satellite, which talks to my computer, so I can download where all the bears are throughout the year, and we can match up the different GPS locations with sea ice from satellite data, and we can really get very fine-scale data on where the bears are, what type of ice they like, where they're hunting, all sorts of incredible information. And just this last year, we finally have technology at a point where we can use GPS ear tags. So now we can track males. We were never able to track males before. Their necks are too thick compared to their head, and they would just pull collars off. Now we give them an ear tag, and we actually know what the boys are doing. So it's been fantastic.
Right. How close do you have to get to a female polar bear to be able to collar it? I mean, that just sounds...
Yeah. Oh, you get hands up. It's only after they've been tranquilized, so that is part of the field work.
But I get there, but how close do you have to get to tranquilize them and shoot the dart?
Oh, I see. Yeah. You know, pretty close. I'm not the one that does the actual shooting, but you do get the helicopter kind of right over them. You know, I would say...
Oh, it's by helicopter.
It is. Yeah. We go by helicopter for those programs. So it takes a really good pilot. That's actually where I met my husband. He's a helicopter pilot that does all the polar bear darting where I was years ago.
Yeah.
So you get right on the bear and you lean out the window and take a shot. And then we wait till it's safely asleep and then we land. And then we try to work quickly, monitor the bear's health while we're doing it. And then we get out of there before it wakes up.
You want to make real sure the bear's asleep before
yeah.
you go up to the bear, right? I mean, that's what we're talking about. You ever had one wake up on you halfway through?
So luckily, it used to happen, you know,
in
the 70s and 80s. We have an excellent sedative right now that has a very clear pattern. As soon as the bear starts shaking its head back and forth, we know it's coming out of the sedative, and it'll be a while before it can get us, but it gives us great warning.
That's time to go then, right?
Yeah. It's waking up, but yeah, so we're very safe out there.
Well, when you're up there and you're trekking around and hiking, can you get close to polar bears, or is that not something you want to do?
Yeah, well, at certain times of the year, there are areas, especially in Canada, you can get very close to polar bears, but we try to be very, very safe. And a lot of what we do is actually at Polar Bears International, we work with the human bear conflict issues. So you don't want to get too close. And if you are going to be close, we hope you're in a group, you're carrying bear spray, you've got a noisemaker, and there's a lot of safety things you want to take into consideration when you're in polar bear country.
Marissa, how do you spread the word about the work you guys do and the predicament that the polar bears find themselves in these days?
That's a good question. I'm glad you asked that. One of the focuses of what we do is conservation outreach. And we do that through several different avenues. One of the reasons that we're here specifically in Kansas City this weekend is to work with one of our Arctic Ambassador Centers, and that's the Kansas City Zoo.
I was going to say, just for the record, you're speaking on Saturday at 1:30, the two of you in the lobby auditorium. The event is free with zoo admission. You can see Marissa and Alyssa at that event. Yeah,
absolutely. So, you know, over 175 million visitors visit zoos and aquariums every year. And so as an Arctic Ambassador Center, they really help us expand our reach and help us work to inspire people to care about the Arctic and its connection to our global climate. And so we're here this weekend to participate in several scientist lectures. And, you know, the Kansas City Zoo also participates in some of our education outreach throughout the year. So in the fall, we have coming up our Tundra Connections program, in which we do mobile broadcasts from the polar bear capital of the world.
Tell us about that, because you have a live cam up there that can monitor the polar bears. What is that, and what do people see if they can engage with that?
So we do have a live cam that you can view via our website, and we do one in partnership with explore.org. And what you can see, especially during these Tundra Connection programs, is we have panelists through our education partnerships. We have scientists, polar bear scientists, climate scientists, education specialists. And you'll view this group of panelists on the Tundra Buggies that we work with Frontiers North Adventures.
Mm-hmm.
And then oftentimes you'll also see live polar bears outside of the windows of these Tundra Buggies.
How many polar bears are there on this planet? Do you have a rough number of how many there are?
A very rough number is 25,000 spread across five countries and 19 subpopulations.
Is that number going down given the sea ice decline?
Yeah, in certain areas we are seeing declines where we've seen loss in sea ice. We've seen changes in polar bear populations. It basically comes down to fewer calories available.
Mm-hmm.
Some areas are still stable because the ice hasn't changed too much where they are. But moving forward, we would expect to see declines with the declining sea ice.
Tell us a little bit, Alyssa, how do they manage to stay warm up there? Because you have a lot of stuff on your website about just how remarkable these animals are. And I just want to go up and put my hands on some of the fur sometime, because it just looks like it's so incredible.
Yeah.
How do they stay warm?
Well, unfortunately, they're kind of smelly, but I guess they are a bear.
Do they smell? They don't look like they
smell. They smell like a big wet dog. Like, they are deceptively clean looking.
Yes, they are.
I think when they're on the ice, they're probably a lot cleaner. We see them a lot on land, of course, when they're waiting for their ice. So they do. They've been rolling in dirt, and they're kind of oily. But they have two layers of fur. So they've got a thick underlayer, which is kind of like us wearing a thick sweater. And then they've got an overcoat layer of longer fur, which is like us them putting a raincoat on. So two layers of fur, they got a thick layer of fat to keep them warm. So they've got these just wonderful adaptations to allow them to live in the Arctic.
Okay, dumb question. Do polar bears ever get cold?
Actually, I think they do. This is something that comes up. They would have some sort of lower limit, and I'm not sure exactly what it is, but, you know, the Kelvin or, I don't know, as low as you could go, they would be cold. They would have a limit, but generally, they are just so happy when it's below freezing. I've seen them at minus 40 degrees Celsius be super fine, super happy. They really perk up when it gets below zero. We see that in Churchill. It'll be, you know, plus, well, I'm sorry, I'm talking in Celsius, but we'll see, you know, a few degrees that's above freezing.
That's a foreign language.
Yeah. Yeah. As soon as it goes below freezing, it's like they just come extra alive and they're rolling around and they're excited for the ice to come back, and whenever there's snow on the ground, they're just, you know, you can tell that's what they want to do.
You know, Marissa, you come from the zoo world. How much of a challenge is it for zoos in the continental U.S. to keep polar bears in a cold enough climate to keep them happy? That's a challenge, isn't it? Because here, I don't know, they roll big chunks of ice into the ponds for the polar bears and they go crazy. They love that
Yeah,
stuff.
I mean, I think there's several things that zoos and aquariums can do to keep polar bears happy in a captive setting. And one of those things is providing them with choices and enrichment. So while you may be unaware of the different choices that the bears have throughout the day, oftentimes there are air-conditioned holding areas, chilled pools. Oftentimes there's cooled rocks. So there's cool water running through the rocks that you're unaware of. So if a bear is perhaps laying in one spot, you might think that that might be an option as well. And there's other strategies that zoos and aquariums can use as well. They can manage their weight. They can keep track of how much the bear weighs and how hot it is, keep track of diets. And really, they really do a really great job of closely watching and monitoring the behavior of the bears on a daily basis.
Alyssa, tell us a little more about their paws and their claws. Mm.
Oh, they're so cool. So their paws can be, you know, the size of a dinner plate. They spread their weight out on their paws, so they can actually walk on quite thin ice because their weight is well distributed. And their claws are very sharply curved. So a grizzly bear claw is longer, more suited for digging, and a polar bear claw is thick and sharp and really suited for grabbing seals and pulling them out of seal holes.
Hey, seals, you know, it sounds so rubbery to me. Why would a seal be so good to eat? Because it doesn't, at least on my, from my vantage point, doesn't look like they would be that good.
Yeah, they just look kind of gross, but it's that blubber.
where it's at.
Yeah, they love, that is where it's at for a polar bear. That is what they want to eat. It's the calories. They just, that's what they're made for.
How tough is it to catch a seal?
I mean, I think it'd be pretty tough for polar bears.
They have
almost,
those claws are curved. So
yeah,
they can catch them. Everything's made so they can catch them. Their jaws are
big.
Yeah,
and their teeth, they have these huge canines and then kind of a gap where basically they're going to try to bite over the seal head and pull it out with their head and claws. They're so powerful. So, yeah, they're just a seal-killing machine, basically.
And they can see in dim light so they can sense movement, too, I've read.
They can. There's a myth out there that bears don't have good eyesight, but they have pretty decent eyesight. So, yeah, and their nose, their sense of smell is fantastic. So between smell and sight, they can really get at those seals.
Now, Marissa, as we've been talking here, so many folks have this natural interest in polar bears. You know, Alyssa just talked to a big group of high school kids here today. If people want to connect and volunteer and help, how can they do that?
That's a good question. Thank you for asking that. So we, you know, while volunteering for Polar Bears International doesn't mean that we can necessarily get you up to see polar bears. We really
Everyone wants to go out and
right?
see the bears. Let's fly up tomorrow and see them, right?
We really do lean on a lot of our partners and a lot of our collaborative relationships to do what we do on a daily basis. And we've got volunteers across the U.S. and Canada in various roles. We rely on folks to help us with education programming, animal science and welfare issues, you know, science and technology. And so we really do rely on those volunteers across the board.
And so people can connect if they go to the website. And
people
they
absolutely can.
Way.
Yep, you can go to our website. You can email us and ask about how you can get connected and work with polar bears. And I'll also say that a good avenue to do that too is with some of our Arctic Ambassador Centers. And
mm-hmm.
so you know, you
like
can,
the zoo,
like the Kansas City Zoo here locally. You can always reach out and see what you can do to volunteer to help there as well.
And again, our two guests will be speaking at the zoo tomorrow at 1:30 in the library auditorium on Saturday at the zoo. The event is free if you get zoo admission. You know, Alyssa, you were saying, you know, you live up there in Jackknife, right?
Yellowknife.
I knew it was a knife. So one of those knives, yeah, in Yellowknife. And tell us where you live. It's so interesting to me. We were talking about it off the air and how often you see bears just outside your windows.
Yeah, so, you know, in Yellowknife, I'm inland enough. We don't get actual polar bears there, but I have lived lived in Churchill, and whenever we spend time in Churchill, yeah, there's a good chance when there's going to be bears. There's certain times we live out on the Tundra Buggy Lodge, which is Frontiers North Adventures lodge that tourists can come stay at. And you wake up for breakfast and, you know, the bears maybe smelled the bacon and they're laying outside, and they go to sleep with you at night, and, you know, you're just are surrounded by bears a lot of the time.
You know, in my college years, I had a chance to work for one summer out in Glacier National Park, and we were told by the rangers, we were terrified, taught to be terrified of the grizzly bears that were out there in great numbers, and you'd see their tracks, you know, in the dirt as you went up on the trail early each morning. But polar bears aren't quite as aggressive, right?
They're not quite as aggressive, but we are very careful about polar bear safety. There was an attack in 2013 in Churchill. One of the things we do at Polar Bears International is work with different groups to bring together specialists in human-bear conflict, basically. How are we going to protect people? One fun thing we just did is we actually made a kid's coloring book based on Churchill to educate the children there about how to stay safe from polar bears when you're on the playground or you're going to your friend's house. How do you keep an eye on for polar bears?
These are problems we don't have here in Kansas City. I've never heard this kind of thing come up.
Yeah, it's a really unique situation.
How do you safe on the playground? How do you stay safe from a polar bear?
Well, you know, we tell kids to stay in groups. If you do see a polar bear, back away slowly. Don't run. Bang some rocks together. If you have food, just drop it. You know, all these little things. And in Churchill, people tend to not lock any doors or vehicles. So there's usually always an avenue you can just go into a car or anyone's house and get out of the way. There's also a polar bear alert team and a polar bear hotline in Churchill. So you can, if you have a cell phone, you can call the polar bear alert team right away and get them over to help you.
The polar bear alert team.
Yep.
Again, we don't have these things.
Yep.
Yeah. Hey, how smart are polar bears?
Oh, they're so smart.
Yeah, that's what I was reading.
Yeah,
bears in general. How can you tell?
You know, just they have these problem-solving things that they do. And actually, maybe Marisa could speak to it. You get to see a bit more of that in zoos because you can actually sit and watch a single bear for a long time. But we see them figure out, well, basically how to get food is one of their main drivers. They can get into
it's their only driver. Come on.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Well, maybe one other driver in the spring,
okay,
but mostly
yes.
food. Yeah. Yeah. But Marisa would know more.
What do you see?
Yeah. Bears are very smart. And one of the things that often happens in zoos and aquariums is husbandry training. And so you can work with an animal, work with a bear to participate in their own health care. And so that really minimizes the amount of time that you're having to immobilize a bear to assess their overall health. Right. So you can train an animal to look at their paws. You can look in their mouths. You can train a recall behavior on animals. So perhaps if they're out on exhibit and something's happened, something's fallen into the exhibit or a containment's been breached, you can recall that animal in.
Yeah.
Some of the research studies that we've collaborated on in zoos and aquariums, one of the most interesting ones in the past that has happened are sensory studies. And so we had staff at the San Diego Zoo working to train animals to recognize a sound. And once they recognized a sound, they were supposed to target, so put their nose on a target. And so that would let the trainer know that they'd heard that sound. And so data from that study, you're able to apply to management decisions in the wild and what can an animal hear, so what type of disturbances might moms and cubs hear in a den.
Oh, that's interesting. You know, they also, polar bears secrete a smell, Alyssa, that's very useful to them. Explain that to us.
Yeah, and this is another thing we found out thanks to captive research. So when females go into estrus in the spring, I mean, we are talking just a huge area, and polar bears aren't just going to randomly bump into each other. So how does a male find a female out there to mate with? And so females, when they are ready to mate, they get smelly footprints, and they leave this hormone smell in their feet. And so once a male can smell it on the air, find the footprints, and he will walk in her footprints until he finds her. It's pretty cool.
And also, they can smell seals from as far away as 20 miles and maybe even 90 miles?
Well, you know, we're not too sure it's that far. We think if there's like a big rotting whale, maybe, and the wind is perfect quite a ways, but we think definitely about, you know, a mile or so if the wind is right. They do use the wind and smell to navigate to a lot of their food.
But they can smell really well.
Really well. Oh, yeah. They got good noses.
Alyssa McCall, Director of Conservation Outreach. Marisa Krause, a Programs Manager for Polar Bears International. Thanks for coming in today. So good to have you guys here. Good
Thanks
luck
for
with
having us. It's
you
been
bet.
Great.